Excuse me, sir. It's Dirk. You're the last case. It's the
I'm sorry, Dirk. McKay versus DHS?
Thank you.
Is that not the correct
You're
case?
You're next.
Did they sit in the wrong pods?
Hmm? No, they're fine right there. It's just the way we had it arranged. Fourth, third.
We need an on-deck session.
Our next case for argument is 20-2128, McDay versus DHS. Ms. Giles, please proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Allison Giles. I'm with the National Treasury Employees Union here on behalf of Petitioner Dante McDay. The arbitration decision upholding Mr. McDay's removal for a single positive drug test had multiple errors that warrant reversal. First, the arbitrator used the wrong standard regarding whether the agency had proven its case against Mr. McDay. Second, the drug test was not done in accordance with the mandatory drug testing guidelines, which require a retest upon request. There is case law holding that when a retest is not done, the original sample must be excluded.
The guidelines don't speak to who has to pay for the retest, correct?
One way or the other, the agency or the employee. When someone's rights are on the line, I think the important issue is the request to a retest honored
He
or
was
not.
Given the opportunity to retest three separate times. Three separate instances he was told he could retest the sample.
The
and
first
he chose
one,
not to.
I'm sorry. On the first time, the arbitrator found that there was confusion about how the payment would work. He did say he wanted a retest. He did say he was willing to pay. He offered to get his credit card in that very first call. 8.5 months later, they did offer again twice, but at that point, his rights had already been violated. He had the right to a retest promptly when the sample was fresh, and he was understandably concerned about the lag of time between the initial test and the subsequent offers.
Is there something in the guidelines that specify the number of days in which a retest must take place?
They do say that the employee has to request it within 72 hours, and there was testimony about the norm is to do the retest within a matter of days. But it doesn't specify how soon the retest must actually be done.
And is it your position that he raised this issue before the arbitrator?
He raised the validity of the retest, that it was not done. That's undisputed. No one disputes that it was not done. And we did raise the issue that absent it being done, the original drug sample
but
should
not
be
not the prepayment issue.
We do think it was raised before the arbitrator. In the issues that we raised, the second one in particular, we think is broad enough to include this issue. On appendix page 2, does the agency's removal of Mr. McDay promote the efficiency of the service? That assumes a valid removal. His removal here is based solely on one piece of evidence, solely on the original drug test.
But like Judge Prosen, I think I understood her question to be, do you have a challenge here to the fact that your client is responsible to pay for that retest? And did you raise that challenge below?
So two issues. I think we do have a challenge. The guidelines don't specify that the employee has to pay. I think when someone's rights are on the line and the guidelines refer to a retest as a right, the agency should do it. I mean, they could have done it and paid and charged him later. I don't think he should have to pay, but they could have done it and billed him later when someone's rights are on the line and this is the sole basis for his removal. The second, the more procedural question, do we raise it below? We raised two broad issues before the arbitrator, and I think this is subsumed within the second one. Does his removal promote the efficiency of the service? That assumes a valid removal. We don't think his removal is valid here because it is based on a single drug test.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just on this point about rights, I mean, people have a right to file a lawsuit. People have a right to file an appeal. Or at least presumptively, there are filing fees that go with that. There are sometimes justifications for not requiring the filing fee to be paid, but payment for the exercise of a right is kind of a pretty common feature of the right and doesn't make it any less a right.
I first distinguish your examples where someone affirmatively chooses to pursue a case. They know that there are going to be various pre-steps to doing that. This is something imposed on him. He was removed based on a drug test, which he said was surprising to him. He didn't think it was, he didn't smoke marijuana, and he was surprised by the test. But second, if they want to have prepayment as a condition of this right,
a defendant in a case brought against it, that I assume, tell me if I'm wrong, if the defendant wants to appeal, presumptively still needs to pay the filing fee for the appeal. That was imposed, the suit was certainly imposed on the defendant in any, that's why they're the defendant.
Right. Putting aside, I'm not familiar with informer pauperis and when a court can waive the fees, but yes, there are rights conditioned on payment. But when it's so important, they should state it explicitly. It wasn't in the guidelines. It wasn't in CBP's own drug testing policy. It wasn't in the medical review officer's guidance. So, and he was willing to...
But it was on the CBP website?
That's the only place it is, on the website, yes. But again, they could have done it and charged him later, and then we may or may not even be here, depending on the results.
Well, we don't accept filings without payment. I mean, you do it and charge him later, and then if he's being removed, what's the potential ability to recoup the money? I mean, I'm looking at the guidelines on page 1118 of the appendix, and it says that a sample is to be retained for a minimum of a year for retesting. So your client may have some personal view that when they came back to him and offered him the retest after his confusion over payment, that it was too late and he was worried about the sample. But according to the actual Federal Register, it says the retesting can take place anytime and the sample has to be retained for that purpose for up to a minimum of a year. So I don't understand what is your rationale for how his rights were violated when they revisited his ability to retest, and he subsequently declined multiple additional times.
What we're saying is rights were violated back at the beginning. You're right. His subjective view was that he was concerned about the degradation of the sample. That is a subjective belief. But we think the violation of the rights occurred 8.5 months previously when he said, I want to retest, willing to pay, and the arbitrator found.
Yes, but why? Okay, even if you were correct, which I do not give you that, but even if you were, there's things called harmless error. And when they came back and allowed for a retest 8.5 months later, when the guidelines explicitly say the sample can be retested for up to a year, why are his rights still violated? Why is it not harmless error? Even if he had that right, why is it not harmless error when they were willing to correct and do it at 8.5 months later?
Well, again, we'd come back to the language saying it is his right, saying that, you know, he believed it should have been done 8.5 months previously, and that is, this isn't a complicated performance case with 10 different factors justifying his removal. There's one and only one piece of evidence supporting the removal.
Well, it's drugs. It's a very serious one. And I'm going to point out, counsel, and this may be a function of your and my respective age, which we share, you alleged that your client denied having smoked marijuana. Do you know that there are many ways to get marijuana into your body? Edibles, which are far more popular now with the kids than apparently smoking marijuana. Did you speak very precisely on purpose, alleged or denied smoking marijuana, or did he deny having consumed marijuana full stop in any capacity?
Well, I don't mean to be parsing language. We agree these CBPOs have an obligation to be drug-free. We understand the importance of the policy, and I didn't mean to parse it. I just can't remember offhand what exactly he said. I'm just saying he said something to the effect that he was surprised by the drug test. I mean, he could have conceded, I suppose, right at the outset, and that's just not what's in the record here.
The arbitrator on page 2 says, grievant denied he smoked or ingested marijuana. Did he, in fact, do that, or was that...
I'd have to look back on his testimony and what exactly he said when he was...
Counsel, a large part of your argument seems to be based on your reading of the arbitrator's opinion as having relied exclusively on the standard of whether the agency's conduct was arbitrary and capricious.
So the only
I'm wondering, the only place I see arbitrary and capricious mentioned, maybe I'm missing something, is that very last paragraph of her opinion, right?
That's correct. That's the only place it's mentioned. It's the only standard mentioned. So either she...
And what was that standard applied to, in your opinion?
Well, I think it's unclear. The government would say it was applied to whether the removal was reasonable. And I would concede that it is the correct standard for that factor. But on whether the agency has proved its case, it needs to be preponderance of the evidence, and there's no dispute That language is not anywhere in the opinion.
But there's no dispute that the party stipulated that, and there's no suggestion that the arbitrator deviated from that other than a statement about arbitrary and capricious at the end dealing with, as the government would say, at least arguably something different.
We did agree on the standard, and she did find the agency proved its case. I would suggest that isn't enough. We are still gleaning from the context whether she used the right standard or not, and we're not supposed to have to guess at her reasoning. It's only 2 pages of reasoning. I would suggest she could have elaborated on what standard she was using and how the evidence supported the agency's decision.
Well, this wasn't that complex a record, right? I mean, the firing, the removal was for the test that showed that he had ingested marijuana. That was the beginning and the end of the case, right?
Yes, but nevertheless, she is silent on what standard she used, or she's either wrong or silent on what standard she used for whether the agency had proven its case. And we think there is case law saying we're not all supposed to guess at what an arbitrator or a lower fact finder meant. I would just touch on my last argument about the due process letter, the due process argument, which is that the agency relied on Mr. McDay's decision to decline the late offer of the retest. The arbitrator's decision on this is solely based on the removal letter, not any of the testimony. And the removal letter mentions his declination of the retest twice in the substantive discussion of what she is using to support the decision. And I will reserve the remainder of my time. Okay, thank you. Ms. Sinani?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Mr. McDay has failed his burden to establish that the arbitrator committed a reversible error in her decision in this case. First, given the limited issues presented to the arbitrator and the specific findings, we can reasonably infer that the arbitrator held the agency to the correct standard of proof. As Your Honors pointed out, both parties stipulated as to the appropriate burden of proof. The agency clearly had to prove by preponderance of the evidence that the charged conduct occurred. The charged conduct here was testing positive for a controlled substance in a random drug test. Here, the arbitrator found that this was an undisputed fact. On page 2 of the appendix, as well as page 4, She states that facts in this matter are not very much in dispute. On August 24th, 2018,
I'm not sure I heard you correctly. The conduct is the smoking or ingestion. The conduct is not the test result. It's just that the test result is the only evidence of the conduct, and in the absence of anything else, it's essentially conclusive.
That is correct, Your Honor. Okay. The arbitrator also found that Mr. McDay's lab results from this test showed that he tested positive for marijuana. The actual validity of the test was not challenged. Now, whether the agency complied with the regulation, with the guidelines, and whether that should have resulted in the exclusion of the test result, that was a separate legal issue. Mr. McDay never even challenged the second prong, which is the nexus requirement. Mr. McDay submitted a 34-page post-hearing brief in which there is no argument regarding whether the agency proved that there was a nexus between the misconduct and the efficiency of the service. Therefore, the arbitrator did not explicitly mention this issue. Finally, the agency had to prove that the penalty of removal was reasonable. Again, it was undisputed that Douglas versus Veterans Administration informs this inquiry. Pursuant to Douglas, the arbitrator properly considers whether an agency-imposed penalty was excessively or clearly excessive or arbitrary, capricious, or unreasonable.
Can I ask you this question? So there's a factual question. Did the individual commit the conduct alleged? Then there's a question about nexus to the efficiency of the service. And then there's a question, as you just put it, reasonableness of the penalty. The arbitrator uses the language of arbitrary and capricious in connection with, well, she uses the phrase the efficiency of the service. That's right. That the person's removal will promote the efficiency of the service. Was this at step two or at step three or what?
This was in step three. That statement she made following her discussion of the Douglas factors. If we look at the arbitrator's decision as a whole, she found the first two prongs were essentially undisputed. So the third prong is whether the penalty imposed was reasonable. And there's a difference between the burden of proof, which is the evidentiary standard to prove the underlying facts, and then the standard of review, which is what is also involved here in that third prong, which is whether the agency's selection of the penalty was reasonable. The agency has considerable discretion in selecting the penalty once all the underlying facts are determined. So although the arbitrator did not specifically mention the preponderance of the evidence burden of proof, that was unnecessary in this case, considering the fact that it was undisputed that that is an appropriate burden. It's also the lowest burden in a civil proceeding.
Does our case law sometimes, never, always connect the Douglas language about the penalty to the efficiency of the service standard of 7513 or whatever it is? Does that efficiency of the service language disappear once the discussion of removal and its justification begins?
Well, Your Honor, the efficiency of the service is under Chapter 75 that the agency can only remove an employee if it promotes the efficiency of the service. And to make that showing, then we have the three prongs that I just mentioned. So they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. Additionally, even if the arbitrator's decision is less than ideally clear, if her reasoning if her path is reasonably discerned, then the court can nonetheless affirm the arbitrator's decision. Second, Mr. McDay fails to provide any authority that would justify exclusion of his primary test result. First, he does not dispute the validity of the test result, or whether the agency complied with the guidelines in collecting and testing and storing the initial specimen. He also provides no authority for the proposition that an agency must cancel the results of the initial test if an employee simply refuses to pay. As Judge Moore mentioned, the guidelines are silent on who gets to or who is responsible for paying the split specimen test. When the drafters of the guidelines initially introduced the split specimen testing into their regulations in 1994, they specifically contemplated whether there should be a requirement in the guidelines whether the employee or the agency decides or should pay for the split specimen testing. We cited the Federal Register, 59 Federal Register 29908. There, the drafters declined to specify and left it to the agency's discretion on who should pay for the test results, for the split specimen testing. The case law upon which Mr. McDay relied on his brief to essentially try to argue that the agency should have canceled his test result does not address the issue of payment. And two, those cases also concern regulations by the Department of Transportation. There, the regulations specifically require the agency to pay for the specimen testing. And in contrast here, the agency had a policy of more than 10 years to require the employees to pay for the specimen testing. As Judge Toronto mentioned earlier, that was going to be one of my examples, that even though the regulations may characterize the split specimen testing as a right, it nowhere mentions that this is an absolute right. And in life, we're entitled to certain rights. For instance, the due process provides a litigant an opportunity to appeal a case. However, that does not mean that the litigant cannot be required to pay certain filing fees before exercising that right. And Mr. McDay mentioned that in this case, just as a defendant, for instance, a criminal defendant might wish to appeal his conviction. So here, Mr. McDay had the possibility to pay a $115 fee to obtain potentially exculpatory evidence to challenge his removal. Third, Mr. McDay has failed to establish that the arbitrator erred when she concluded that she lacked the authority to consider the issue of whether the agency's policy of requiring the payment was lawful. That there was a procedure in place by which the parties were required to submit their issues before the arbitrator. 20 days before the hearing, the parties were required to submit either their issues jointly or, if they could not agree, separately. Here, the arbitrator specifically adopted Mr. McDay's phrasing of the issues, and the issue of the legality of the agency's policy was not presented to for decision.
And that's the sole basis on which you think the arbitrator says she didn't have the authority to address the question, not something like arbitrators don't get to say whether the agency is acting illegally or something like that.
Yes, that is our position. She did say that she lacked the jurisdiction to consider the issue based on the issues presented. Or I could find the exact quote, but she specifically mentioned that based on the issues presented, she lacked jurisdiction to decide.
Can I ask you a different question, which I don't think we heard about this morning, which is whether the deciding official did in fact rely on the repeated refusal to have the split specimen tested. I know that your position is that the deciding official did not in fact rely, so that whether there was a notice problem doesn't arise. Do you agree that if the deciding official had relied on that, that there would be a notice problem, say under the Doe case, D-O, or Do, I don't know how to pronounce that, I'm sorry, that notice was not given, we plan to rely on this evidence?
Well, Your Honor, we would posit that even if the decision maker, which his testimony clearly states that he did not consider this evidence, but
the testimony, right?
Sure.
They rely on what the letter says.
Even if he had relied on this information, that would still not amount to due process violation under the circumstances of this case, because Mr. McDay had notice of the existence of this information and opportunity to respond. In April and May of 2019, communications between the agency and Mr. McDay, which are set forth in Appendix 1442 through 1446, show that the agency provided him the two opportunities to get the split specimen tested, and he declined both offers. On both emails in which he declined the offers, Mr. McDay, through his union representative, provided a half page of text describing in details the reasons for declining the split specimen testing. Thus, he had notice and opportunity to respond to this information. Additionally, the proposal notice noted that Mr. McDay had requested the split specimen testing, but as of that date, he had not yet paid for it, and therefore no second test was conducted. So even in the proposal letter, this issue was mentioned. He had the opportunity in both oral replies to address it, and chose not to do so. He chose not to get the test and sufficiently provided his reasons for why he did not want to do so.
And he was represented by the union representative at that point, right?
He was represented. The proposal, the notice of proposed removal was sent to him on October 17 of 2018. The following day, the agency sent Mr. McDay and his union representative all the materials relied upon. So at least as of the date following his proposed removal, he was represented by counsel. Based on these reasons and those articulated in our brief, Your Honors, we would respectfully request that you affirm the arbitrator's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Childs, you have rebuttal time.
Sorry.
Thank you. Just two small points just to make sure the timeline's clear. His proposed removal letter was October of 2018. His declination of the late offer of the retest occurred in April and May of 2019, so those were not mentioned in the proposed removal letter. And second, counsel refers to the testimony of the deciding official on what he relied on. The arbitrator does not cite to that. She only relies on the removal letter itself, which I think speaks for itself. And happy to respond to any more questions. Otherwise, we'll rely on our briefs.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank both counsel. This case is taken under submission.